Okay, so the goal of the talk is basically trying to remind ourselves of where psychoanalysis started from, what its main thesis has been. So we have very contradicting schools in psychoanalysis, which focus on several aspects of the treatment of the cure. But if there's one kind of fundamental aspect which is tied to psychoanalysis since its beginning, is the concept of talking and the concept of free association. And this concept of talking or speech and free association is so badly tied to psychoanalysis that it is both theoretically and therapeutically important in consideration. So, whether you're kind of trying to do critical theory or, philosophically trying to approach psychoanalysis, you have to go through the aspect of speech. So, one of the questions that we can ask, one of the questions that we can ask in today's talk is basically, what can a therapy do in the interchange of words? What actually means to have a therapy in play of words? And, well, one of the things that we can say a therapy can have is basically the therapy allows to see what the unconscious is like, what the unconscious can manifest by allowing a mode of free association, that is, without putting limits on what can or cannot be expressed or said in terms of speech. So I'll just make a slight side remark on how we do it in theory. So in theory, the psychoanalysis rests on the fact that everything is explained in the psyche. For every explanations, we're going to look into the psyche, whether it's the unconscious, the ego, the id, whatever, it's in the psyche. Now, where is the psyche? Well, that is a big question in philosophy of mind. People, they try to answer the mind-body problem, whether the psyche is in the mind or the consciousness is in which you have the mind. But instead of going into the debate, we can say, rather than being worried about mind versus matter, we can say we can have a theory which is based on signs and signification. So we're now concerned with the theory of mind, which is based on how things are represented through the mind. So we are not concerned whether the mind, the psyche is in the body, whether how it's related to the matter, but we're more concerned about how it can represent things. How does it develop signs, right? So already we have taken a very linguistic route in how to approach psychoanalysis. Now, the discovery of how speech can be important goes back to the hysteria cases, which Freud tried to develop along with his master Charcot. But one of the things that he differed from Charcot is basically Charcot's belief that to treat the hysteric, you need to go through the process of hypnosis, and his theory of aphasia and other things related to hysteria were mostly based on suggestion, right? That is, it's through suggestion, through hypnosis, that you can kind of treat hysteria. And it was very successful because Charcot is arguably the only person who has done the highest number of works on hysteric patients. But Freud kind of deviated from Charcot and his student, Charcot's follower, so to speak, Pierre Janet, in that we are more concerned about what the hysteric has to say and what the verbal representations are than how the suggestion affects. So now we're not trying to suggest and then listen to the hysteric, but rather we're listening to the hysteric without giving any suggestions and then seeing that how they speak, and in the speaking there comes a change, right? And this is very nicely put in a quote by Freud, which is that just give me a second, I lost the quote. Yes. So this Freud says in his first paper on aphasia. So he's, you know, trying to write an article about aphasia, which is going to go to a medical textbook, and he says, "Words are the essential tool of mental treatment. A layman will no doubt find it hard to understand how pathological disorders of the body and the mind can be eliminated by quote unquote mere words. He will feel that he is being asked to believe in magic, and he will not be so very wrong, for the words which we use in our everyday speech are nothing other than watered-down magic, but we shall have to follow a roundabout path in order to explain how science sets about restoring to words part, at least, of their former magical power." Right? So here you can see Freud, in one of his very early writings, has already decided how essential words are in mental treatment, right? And this is the first time Freud is deviating from Charcot, and because here he's no longer just considered in the somatic and the biological processes and the suggestion that Charcot developed, but he's more concerned about words in themselves. So Freud goes on to develop this more and more. You have the famous case of Anna O, which is the first time Breuer tried this cathartic method, and you know we have the famous case. And then he wrote two major books on this, Jokes and the importance of jokes in the unconscious, and the other one is Psychopathology of Everyday Life. Those two books show you how much merely words can tell you about many kinds of psychopathology. Right? Now, one of the things that a psychoanalysis tries to not do is boil down the subject to its symptoms, right? So in psychoanalysis, we're not concerned about the subject in the ways it manifests symptoms, or that you have these lists of symptoms so you can be put into this or that category, but psychoanalysis tries to analyze how the symptoms are related to the subject. So how does psychoanalysis actually do that? Now, this is explained in a very nice quote by Serge Benevento in his book Seven Conversations with Lacan. And he says, "The psychoanalyst aims at the fact that suffering subjects are theaters of diverging wills, are divided, split, and the analytic technique is based on this ethical choice not to stitch up this division, but to bring it into the light of the day," right? So here we can see the psychoanalyst is, of course, he acknowledges the fact that subjects are suffering. But as Benevento says, suffering subjects are theaters of diverging wills. So you have like not what is it, uniform will, like a one directional will, but rather it's diverging and is divided and is split. And what the analyst does not do is stitch up this division or stitch up this split, but rather it brings it into the light of the day, right? So this is what we mean when we say the goal of psychoanalysis is not to boil down the subject to its symptoms, but rather analyze the relation between the symptoms and the subject, the structure itself. So when you bring into light this split and the dividedness, which is at the center of the subject, you're doing psychoanalysis. So this is going to be very helpful when you have the example of what is not psychoanalysis. So what is not psychoanalysis? You have different kinds of psychotherapies with different, you know, efficiency levels and all of that. So you have CBT, cognitive behavioral, you have hypnotherapy, and you have all kinds of ways to, you know, deal with human suffering, so to say. But let's take an example. So, you know, you have a person who always kind of misses the train, right? So it's kind of like the patient has so much anxiety that he almost always gets to the station 5 minutes late when the train is supposed to go. So like he's always 5 minutes late. So he goes to a therapist and he kind of presents his problem that, you know, he's always missing the train. Like, this is an important thing. He's kind of, you know, missing out on work, and he's, you know, it's affecting his financial life and all of that. So what a cognitive therapist or a cognitive model would kind of try is that, okay, his problem is he cannot catch the train. We are going to sit down and find ways to solve this problem on how he can catch the train. Right. And he, of course, after some period of, you know, how long the therapy can go, he should be able to catch the train. You know, that is solve the problem. That is what he was in therapy for. Right. But what a psychoanalyst would do is that, wait a second, what exactly are we doing here? We let him catch the train, but what if him missing the train was only because his relation with his goal, you know, the destination of the train, is not the nicest? It's because maybe he now catches the train with the help of the therapy. He can now catch the train, but the train takes him to a much more defective and, you know, kind of not a nice place, a place which is kind of not ideal. Right. So in cognitive model, you never worried about the situation. You're not concerned about where the train takes you. You're concerned only the fact that this person has anxiety and he cannot catch the train. We're going to help him catch the train. Right. So in psychoanalysis, we're kind of questioning the goals, so to speak, of what people can say. So people can say, okay, I have problems in, you know, dealing with, I don't know, women, or dealing with friends, and dealing with work, and all of these. And the analyst is not going to say, okay, so that is your problem, we're going to solve that. No, the analyst is going to rather make you speak about it. And in this speaking about it, you will question whether the destination of the train is something you want to go or not. So I believe this is a very nice way to differentiate what psychoanalysis is and what it isn't. And how speech is the very thing that makes them different. So this is precisely the what I would say as the rediscovery of Lacan in psychoanalysis, because after Freud, you did not have a lot of people going back to language, going back to speech. And we realized there have been many mistakes made because of, you know, ignoring this aspect of psychoanalysis. Object relations, ego psychology, all are symptoms of this ignorance, so to speak. Okay, so now I'm going to go ahead and kind of say a bit about how speech is related to symptoms and the suffering of the symptoms. So in the last presentation, I kind of said, I brought up a quote from Alenka Jupancic, her book on what is sex. And she said how what one brings to analysis is always a self-cure, right? It's kind of like you have developed a set of symptoms and you're kind of trying your way to handle those set of symptoms. And that kind of handling actually creates more suffering than you would, you know, imagine. So it's kind of like it's always a subjective way to solve something, and the psychoanalyst doesn't give you another solution. The psychoanalyst just tells you that there's a contradiction, your solution is not going to work, rather there is no solution, and you'll kind of have to get over that. So again, when we try to imagine what does it mean to have symptoms, what does it mean to speak about symptoms? And part of how you approach that is, you know, again, going back to Freud. So Freud emphasized on speaking, but what happens when you don't speak? Well, if speaking is the way to cure, or speaking is the first step towards like anything therapeutic, not speaking must be a way to be ill, right? And this is what Freud did say in his early works, again, Studies on Hysteria and other things, where he said, you know, referring to a very well-known maxim that civilization started when someone, instead of hitting someone with a stone, just said an insult, right? So, you know, you're talking to me, you said something bad to me, I don't beat you, I don't kill you, but rather just say an insult to you. So, you know, Freud goes back to that kind of idiom, and he says, it is important on why people have developed this way of speaking about things when it is not nice, like when they feel hurt or when they feel like affected. And this kind of trying to, like, you know, displace actions with speech is precisely how somatic things get turned into symptoms in speech, and vice versa, how speech can lack of speech or kind of a repression of speech can lead to somatic symptoms. And this is what you call conversion in hysteria, a conversion, psychosomatic conversion hysteria. So that is precisely what it is to have symptoms in psychoanalysis, is that you have a traumatic event and you don't have a way to kind of make sense of it, so to speak. And in kind of trying to make sense of it, you develop symptoms. And in dealing with the symptoms, you create the self-cure, as I said. And now when you go to the analyst, you have some things to say. And whatever you say is related to this big chain, big complex, right? So the speech is related to symptoms. Symptoms are related to your way of dealing with the trauma, and trauma is related to other things. So you can see how speech is almost the surface, right? It's the ice on which you skate. And as Lacan always kind of emphasized, it's not that we need to go deeper somewhere beyond speech. Rather, your goal is to stay on the surface and decipher things in relation to each other, right? So again, as I said, you know, a theory of mind which is built with representations on how things are signified and how signs work in relation to each other, that is what you do. You're not kind of looking for anything beyond speech, but you're looking things in speech. So that is how a subject develops symptoms in relation to their events that happen. Now, in speech, you have various kind of things representing, you know, various aspects of what you're trying to say, right? Now Freud, again early in his work on aphasia, said about two such things. He said about word presentations and thing presentations, right? So what happens is basically you have this is a quote from Freud again, who says, "We learn to speak by associating a word sound image," under quotes, "with an impression of word intervention. When we have spoken, we are in possession of a kinesthetic word image, that is, of the sensory impressions on the organs of speech. The motor aspect of word is therefore doubly determined." So here, what Freud is saying is that, When we're learning to speak by kind of associating a word sound image. So word sound image is basically a kind of representation of an image. It's related to a sound and it has a word, right? So maybe, for example, I can talk about a fan, right? So the fan, I have the image of the fan, the sound of the fan, and the word fan itself. So, you know, this, you associate this word sound image with an impression of word intervention, right? So, like, what does the word kind of have an impression on me? And how is it related to this word sound image? This is how you speak. So the word sound image is basically thing presentations. It is the presentations of the thing as object. And these impression of word intervention are word presentations. And word presentations are just presentations of words. For example, the word apple, right? So the apple has, of course, the red thing, just the thing presentation. But the word apple, A-P-P-L-E, and everything like the signifiers in it and everything else, that itself makes up the word presentation. And you, like, to speak, you have to associate the thing presentation with the word presentation, and in aphasia, you lose that. So, because before Freud, aphasia was understood purely from an anatomical perspective. But Freud, building on the works of Wernicke and a few other like old school traditional psychologists, he was able to kind of bring in the linguistic side of aphasia. So he said, and I quote, "The word is the functional unit of speech. It is a complex presentation constituted of auditory, visual, and kinesthetic elements," right? So you can see this is the first time Freud starting to say how, you know, the word has auditory things in it, has visual side to it, and has kinesthetic elements to it. So this is what I said about thing presentations and word presentations. Okay, so that is how, you know, words and, you know, aphasia is related according to Freud's understanding. Now, what happens in hysteria? Well, in hysteria, what happens is basically the thing presentations are somatic. So you have some kind of somatic illness, and you have word presentations associated with that. So you have, like the Amy Vaughan's case, you have the, you know, burnt pudding, and the burnt pudding is associated with the smell of, you know, something burning, the burnt pudding. And you can see here, the pudding, the burnt pudding, that kind of word or signifiers are related with the smell, some kind of aesthetic element to that. And this is kind of what I'm trying to propose here, right? So again, what does an analyst do with all this? Like if an hysteric comes to your clinic, or you know, any other person comes to your clinic and you hear them speak, what exactly should you be doing? And like, how should you be listening, or how should you be kind of deciphering their speech, right? As you know, most contemporary Lacanians agree, what the analyst basically does is gives kind of markers on what the person should be speaking about. It's kind of like, the analyst is the person who should be speaking the least. The analyst does not speak. The analyst only kind of hints where the analyzon should be speaking, right? So, unlike what you see in most of Freud's cases and how authoritative he can be, ideally, an analyst is someone who is trying to never say any authoritative statement. He's only trying to make the subject question on things that he or she thinks he's totally sure about, right? And in kind of making the person, you know, speak again and kind of make themselves explain, the subject realizes what exactly the word presentations are related to the thing presentations. So for example, you know, I can just say that I don't like being on internet. Or like, internet is very kind of toxic. I meet a lot of weird people. I don't like it. So I just kind of course, I don't explain all that. I just say, I don't like internet. That's what I say. Now, the analyst is not going to say, again, the internet is not bad, internet can be good, it depends on how you do it, on all of that. The analyst is not going to say all of that. The analyst is going to say, what do you mean when you say you don't like internet? Or, again, always trying to analyze the relation between what has been said about not liking internet and how that not liking signification is related to their own thing presentation, what they think when they say internet, what visual or auditory imagery comes to their mind when they say they don't like internet. So this kind of gap is what the analyst tries to kind of analyze or kind of question, right? So again, when you do not have this, when you kind of do not speak, or kind of there is a very barrier, strong barrier towards speaking, it really becomes very bad. So, you know, I quote again from Freud, from his 1893 paper. He says, let us suppose that a man is insulted, is given a blow, or something of the kind. The psychical trauma is linked with an increase in the sum of excitation of his nervous system. There then instinctively arises an inclination to diminish this increased excitation immediately. So you have the increase in excitation in the nervous system, and you know, you're trying to diminish it and balance it. So, you know, in response to the insult, he hits back and then feels easier. He may perhaps have reacted adequately. That is, he may have got rid of as much as had been introduced onto him. The most adequate reaction is always a deed. So someone said anything or did anything to him, he gave an adequate response and feels kind of easier. But here's the remark, as I made earlier, but as an English writer has wittily remarked, the man who first flung a word of abuse at his enemy instead of a spear was the founder of civilization. Thus, words are substitutes for deeds, and in some circumstances, for example in confession, the only substitute. An insult that has been repaid, even if only in words, is recollected quite differently from one that has had to be accepted. And linguistic usage characteristically describes an insult that has been suffered in silence for mortification. So, you know, the last sentence itself says the most important thing that I want to explain is an insult that has been repaid, even if it's just in words, is recollected quite differently from one that has had to be accepted. So, for example, you have an insult that you repay, as he said, you know, just by saying another insulting thing to the same person. You remember that differently from something which you just had to accept. You know, for example, someone said anything very insulting to you, and you did not necessarily say anything back, or you did not hit back, but you just had to accept it. And this kind of suffering in silence of this insult is what Freud calls as mortification. Right? So what makes the patient ill is this silence, quite literally. And again, when you fall ill, you come to this analyst again, and he's going to make you say those things that you could not say, so that you realize what is this, again, bridge between the thing presentation and the word presentations. So now there's a kind of feeling that these thing presentations exactly what is in the unconscious. It's like the unconscious makes up these images, makes up these kind of relationship with the sounds and these things. And this is what the unconscious is. It's like all that the unconscious has are all these connections of pictures, of memories, of smells, and all of these things to some objects. And again, to make the unconscious conscious is basically try to see what these thing presentations are. But that is what Lacan disagrees with, and what he says is basically the unconscious is not something that is filled with thing presentations. The unconscious is what makes thing presentations possible, right? So this is partly, very, you know, in a fraction of a manner, what Lacan means when he says the unconscious is structured like a language, is that the unconscious is what makes it possible for you to have thing presentations and word presentations, and this gap between them. So it is not a category which contains only thing presentations. It is what allows for both of them to be possible. And you know, you see that in the speech. Okay. So now I have a few more things before I come to an end. Those are slightly off the direct topic, but they're about ambivalence. What ambivalence means in psychoanalysis and how it is related to speech. Now, ambivalence is, in psychoanalysis, is basically the simultaneous existence of contradictory tendencies. You have love and hate. to the same object. But you have to realize that ambivalence doesn't mean a quote-unquote mixed feelings. That's kind of how people misunderstand it. Mixed feelings means you have kind of imperfect understanding of something. But ambivalence means you have two opposite feelings or two opposite affects coming from the same source and going to the same object, right? And they're interdependent. So you have love and hate being interdependent, and they're directed towards a single object. And but at the same time, they don't, in some sense, are harmonious. It's just the coexistence of two opposites. So that's ambivalence. Now, ambivalence goes back to Bleuler, Eugen Bleuler, the famous psychiatrist who worked on schizophrenics, right? And Bleuler had four fundamental symptoms of schizophrenia. Those are the four A's. One is affect, and then there's association, ambivalence, and autism. And this is a very famous, of course, founding of Bleuler, but we'll just only focus on the ambivalence symptom. In ambivalence, Bleuler talks about affective ambivalence, ambivalence of will, and intellectual ambivalence. Now, what kind of ambivalence you see in the speech of the schizophrenic, right? And this is how these three categories are made. So in affective ambivalence, you have the husband who loves and hates his wife, right? So, you know, you have, if you look at Bleuler's book on schizophrenics, you have a very short vignette about a wife who thinks that his husband, her husband should come and save her from someone who's trying to kill her. But at the same time, she says her husband is also trying to kill her. So, you know, she says this in a very interesting way, when referring to her husband, you devil, you angel, you devil, you angel. And she repeats it until some time, and trying to kind of express how she has this contradictory feelings about him, right? So that is affective ambivalence. Now, ambivalence of will and intellectual ambivalence are similar. In ambivalence of will, you're basically trying to do and not do the same thing at the same time. So you can try to eat and not eat at the same time. So you can take the spoon to your mouth, not eat. Intellectual ambivalence is much more interesting in that it can basically be confusing. So it's kind of like there's again a vignette from Bleuler who says, when one expresses a thought, one always sees a counter thought. So basically, he has a thought, but he doesn't know if that is a thought or not. So, you know, what I'm trying to say with the concept of ambivalence is basically, it's in speech and also sometimes in somatic symptoms that you see ambivalence happening. But at the same time, instead of saying that ambivalence is something that you only see in schizophrenics, the goal of the goal of Freud is basically trying to explain that ambivalence is at the center of the human subject. You are fundamentally ambivalent, and you're fundamentally divided between love, hate, indifference, and all the other contradictory feelings. And one sees, again, this kind of ambivalence in speech of specific kind of patients, right? So you have the schizoid, which is very widely considered or kind of widely read in object relations, right? because the schizoid, when you ask him, what is it that you want, or like, what is your problem, do you think? And the schizoid is basically going to say you that my problem is that I'm not being loved. And like, I want to be loved.
Right.
But schizoid, when you see them talking to their loved person or interacting with the loved person, they're basically saying things that will make them away from the loved person. So again, you see in speech how these opposite things can take the same place, so to speak, right? So you can have this schizoid talking about love in a manner which signifies hatred underlying it, but at the same time, it can also signify the lack of love, right? So when a schizoid says about love, you should never consider it in a kind of standalone manner. Okay, this is love. This is what you can kind of, you know, you normally think about it and whatnot. You have to, again, understand or kind of make them speak about how is it that they relate this. And this is very clear in a case vignette. So I'm going to end this with a case vignette which kind of sums the goal of what I'm trying to say. So you have a young woman from London, and she comes to analysis with a profound depression. That's what she says. And the profound depression basically happens after a kind of breakup she had with an American man. So the story is, the young woman from London was in a long distance relationship with an American guy, and the relationship went for 2 years, and every other week one of them would travel to each other's country to see each other, right? So sometimes the guy from America would come to London, and sometimes the woman would go there. Now what happens is, after 2 years, both of them decided that they should start living together. That, you know, this long distance, it's too much of, you know, a mess. You know, you have to plan a flight, you have to, you know, go, and it was very hard, you know, practically speaking. So both of them decided that they want to relocate and start living together, start having, so to say, an actual relationship, whatever that might mean. Now, in the beginning, the girl, the woman, was very, very happy about it. You know, finally, the partner has agreed to relocate to London, and she doesn't have to deal with the jet lags and kind of, you know, anxiety that you have in these kind of relationships. But what happened is, interestingly, the partner from America comes to London. Now they start living together. But after just a few days of his arrival, she became sad, inert, and anxious. That's what she says. And she grew distant, depressed, and indifferent towards the relationship and towards the person. What happened, as you can expect, in a few days or weeks, the relationship collapsed, and she became really depressed after that. So we can pause and think about why this happened, or for what kind of reasons, you know, one can say such a thing would happen, because she, you know, was able to have what she wanted, which is to live together with a boyfriend. But when exactly that thing happened, she became sad, inert, and anxious. Now, you can have immediate explanations to these things from this information coming from various schools. For example, in attachment theory, a good explanation can be that of avoidant the attached person. So this girl seems to be, you know, depicting the symptoms or what do you say, the nature of what an avoidant person does. The avoidant person, it's not that they don't want love or they don't want affection. They want, it's just that when you become too close, they have to step back, right? Because they're insecure. That's one form of insecure attachment. So you can explain using attachment theory that the distance was okay for the girl, but when the distance was closed, you basically got, you know, too intimate, and as she's an avoidant person, you know, that doesn't work. That is one of the explanations. And, you know, you can have another, you know, quasi-Lacanian or whatever explanation, which is that like it was the kind of distance which was keeping up the relationship, and it, like, she never really loved the man. She only loved this distance, so to speak. And when this distance was gone, she realized that her love was just an illusion, and she fell into depression. That is another explanation. And my goal, after ending this case vignette, is basically that starting to explain things in this manner is basically going against the first thesis of psychoanalysis, which is to listen to the speech. So, continuing the vignette, actually what happened in the analysis of the girl is that she continues the analysis, and in one way or another, the analysis takes the turn into childhood and turns into several events in the childhood. Now, one of the things she talked about in her analysis is how she felt when she was told about the death of her father. It was a very kind of unexpected and surprising thing. And she remembered how she was taken out of classroom, and how nobody actually told her how the father died. She was never able to, so to say, process the mourning, right? And she was speaking about this in analysis. And in doing that, she immediately made another kind of jump into speaking about the boyfriend, about the relationship. Now she was speaking, now the analyst actually asked her, what is it that was actually most important in the relationship with the guy? And she tried to remember, and she made an association between the incident with the father and the relationship, which is basically, in the long distance relationship, every week that she had to leave London, or he had to, you know, go back to his country, they had a very kind of regular ritual, which is that of passionately holding each other and crying and expressing how hard it is for them to leave after meeting, and, you know, the separation and all that. So after each meeting, when someone is going to leave, you know, at the airports, she remembers hugging and holding and crying passionately for the separation. Now, what happens is this magic in speech is basically, when she makes this association, she now realizes that what kept her in the relationship is actually that, in trying to, you know, go back and come to one country and another, she was able to cry, and she was able to express the mourning that she was never able to process since the death of her father, right? So the relationship actually allowed her to do the process of mourning in a very indirect manner, and she was never able to realize this until only several years later in analysis, right? So that is the end of the case vignette. And like, the main point, as you might have picked up, is basically, in speaking about two entirely different things, you have an association which tells you about how the subject relates to events or relates to events. So now, you know, you no longer immediately should jump onto, what is it, the love or the separation or the distance or anything else. You should first have to listen what associations have been made with this thing and how is she speaking about it. And in that speaking, you know, again, you can't say how, but somehow you should be able to find out a way of relating things. And that is all I have. Thank you for listening.
Amazing presentation. Amazing presentation. Really.
You think so?
Yes, I don't know. I don't understand why you apologize. Now I'm like, why did he apologize? It was really good and really exhaustive, actually.
Yeah.
There were a lot of angles that you took that were interesting. And actually, the case vignette is a really good one. I also liked the metaphor of the train, which was quite interesting. Now, I have only one question before I go.
Mm-hmm.
I have to work. What do you make of other aspects of the analysis besides speech, besides talking? Because I understood that at first you explained going back to Freud. Actually, going back to Freud with Lacan is going back to speech.
Mm-hmm.
And you explained that. But I always struggle with the other aspect of the psychotherapy, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Body language, maybe tone, maybe even like, I mean, for example, in psychosis, I don't know how you say that in English, hypochondria, you know, it's like this in English, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Let me see,
hypochondria.
Okay, yeah. Hypochondria is actually this object A going into the body and localizing actually the object in the body itself, moving, creating symptoms and all that stuff. And it has actually, I mean, you could argue this has something to do with speech, but at the same time, this is a whole other aspect that you cannot speak about really, or maybe, I mean, that's not true, because I ask my patient, okay, you say you have, this syndrome. I don't understand. I'm not a doctor. Please explain to me, what do you understand by this symptom?
Mm-hmm.
And so we transform that into speech. But what do you do? Do you think we can argue that psychoanalysis dismisses the other aspect of a therapy?
I think so. I certainly think so, that it, if not dismisses, it diminishes other aspects. And I think there are sometimes good reasons and sometimes not so good reasons. After that, I'll also like to point out that speech is not always verbal. Speech is not always something necessarily spoken. You have a silence, which can also be interpreted as speech. Basically, how the kind of person relates to silence and how the person kind of speaks about silence even. So I think, I mean, of course, there are various other aspects to the subject and its symptoms. But I believe that psychoanalysis starts from the basic assumption that what makes us different from animals is basically that we have language.
Right.
So, I mean, that's the basic assumption. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, for a contemporary analysis,
mm-hmm.
which means a modern analysis, do you think the next goal of analysis is to include as much aspects other than language? I mean, not mm-hmm. to say that we are done with language, that we mm-hmm. cover all. That's not what I'm saying. But should psychoanalysis in the future strive to include more aspects of the analysis, or really mm-hmm. we are going for a purist Lacanian view on language and only language?
Okay, so I think
mm-hmm. yeah.
Sorry, you wanted to go.
But this is more of a no. But I'm sorry, because this question is not really objective. It's more like an opinion.
Yeah, right. Yes, there's not a definite
more than
answer.
Anything. So
yeah.
Yes.
So I think a contemporary form of psychoanalysis should try other methods. Should try to understand mm-hmm. other methods. But I don't think you can have psychoanalysis without speech or speaking and free association. If you take that out, I think you're mm-hmm. done with psychoanalysis. So that is what I think. But at the same time, I also believe that you can have interesting intersections. It's like, again, the work of Van der Kolk, remember the trauma?
Yes. Bessel van der Kolk, yes.
Who used,
the body forgets nothing or something like this. Yeah.
The body speaks. I forgot the name of the book.
It was like Never Forgets or something like this, no?
Yeah.
The
body keeps a score.
It keeps the score, yeah.
So you can have interesting intersections like that. But at the same time, I think there is a kind of tendency of people to leave
mm-hmm.
speech and free association when things get hard, things get harder. You have the whole field of object relations, which is concerned about the mother-infant relation, but is never concerned about speech in itself, right? You don't have, what is it, maybe Melanie Klein speaking about mm-hmm. How important it is. So, like, we have to realize limitations, but at the same time, if something kind of, just because something can be explained clinically doesn't mean we have to go against the theory. So that is why theory is actually important, because clinically things can work. Clinically you can do body therapy and things can work. But at the same time, you have to have a theoretical background for it. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So actually you think that, yes, we should include as other aspects, but at the same time, the one that is not often included is speech. It's also often left aside. Yeah. I agree with that statement. Thank you. I will have to go right mm-hmm. now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry I cannot stay longer, but this was amazing. I hope you recorded it, because I think a lot of you can send a lot of new people to
mm-hmm.
you know, the guys that are new to psychoanalysis to this presentation. I think it's a very good introduction to what actually is understood when we speak about speech. Great presentation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Hamid.
Thank
for
you,
coming.
Thank you, Jaden. It was a really good presentation.
Yeah. Thank you, Hamid, for joining. I think it must be too late for you. Did you like it?
It's about 11:30 p.m. in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working on dinner, I'm cooking.
I see.
I'm cooking dinner.
Yeah, what did you think about the presentation? Any interesting thoughts?
Yeah, it was awesome. I couldn't imagine how you did great, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The way you presented it was obvious that you are dominant in this field, you know? You know what you say. And you have read too much.
I guess, yeah. The thing is, this was not as planned. I wish I had kind of spent mm-hmm. more time with kind of writing slides and kind of making it more organized. But half of it was almost free association.
No, that was really awesome.
Yeah.
You look dominant on that topic you presented. I was wondering about to make presentation of one of the Sphinx vignette, clinical vignette, that she talks about an obsessive person, and another one is about the hysteric patient we had met.
Who talks about it?
Bruce Fink.
Fink in which book?
He has a clinical introduction to.
Okay, clinical introduction.
Lacanian psychoanalysis.
Interesting.
Yeah. I can bring those cases to one or more session.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I guess.
If you kind of.
And we can talk about them.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's okay.
Sorry?
Is it okay to bring those cases?
Yeah, sure. I mean, everything is welcomed. Oh. More like clinical cases are more welcome. So yeah, feel free. Yep.
And I must mention that when you were talking about the hysteria that Paulette Soler, you know,
mm-hmm.
she disagrees with this form of translating hysteria and kind of conversion symptoms. She says that she formulated in another way.
Mm-hmm.
I try to say something about that, you know. In the hysteria today, she says that that's not the kind of hysteria that Freud and Lacan talks about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the conversion, you know.